Welcome to Cooking the Books, an interview series about food and fiction. I'm your host, Alia Dibodard.
And I'm your host, Fran Wild. Welcome, Ken Liu, to Cooking the Books.
Thank you for having me, Fran.
You're welcome. Hey, actually, this is welcome back because we had you here for Grace of Kings.
That's right.
And we talked about the tavern and we talked about street food. And I think we're going to talk about the tavern again.
That sounds good.
Today, we are talking about Wall of Storms. And it is big. It is a fat book. But it's a great read.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
I really did. The politics and the court intrigues that you had going were captivating, but also just the way everything was constructed. You know, I'm a sucker for good engineering.
Yes. Well, that's why we're such good friends, right?
Also, though, you did capture court life in lots of different ways, including with the food. Tell us a little bit about Wall of Storms from your perspective.
Oh, sure. Okay. So The Grace of Kings was in many ways a book about legends. So even though it's an epic fantasy and you're learning about the exploits of characters like Kuni and Mata in real time, they're already, in some sense, legends. And so the style of the book is written deliberately to evoke an epic poetry feel, where the heroes are larger than life and what they do is, you know, mythical, even as they occur. The Wall of Storms is a little bit different in that now the focus is on the next generation. And so it is a book in some ways about reading myth and interpreting myth and how to make use of history. It's about what happens after a revolution and trying to construct a new society, a new order after the old order has been overthrown.
You do this a little bit more neatly than I do.
Well, I was just about to say, unlike a certain other novel by a friend Wild I know, in her great fantasy series, in which the second book is about, you know, what happens after the revolution. Yeah. So I thought there would be some natural synergy between
Definitely.
Our books.
Yep. If you like one, like the other, you know.
I would hope so.
I think that's really an interesting and pretty exquisite explanation of both books together. Now there's a third you're working on as well, but I want to talk about just the first two, because you said the first one is a book about legends, and the second one is basically a book about intrigue.
Then. Right.
And that follows the pattern of a lot of epics told in the tradition, because we talked a little bit about the tradition of the Grace of Kings and how the telling of it reflected certain traditional epics.
Right.
Last time. So I think the shift in from the greater epic and the legendary and sort of the there are so many different traditional epics that follow this pattern that deal with legends in the first go and then get down to sort of brass tacks with people in the second go and people hacking and people politics and things like that.
Right.
That this is really fascinating and it creates a different rhythm and pattern to the book.
Right. And I was also trying to, you know, keep the reader on their toes a little bit. You know, I think I mentioned this when I was talking about The Grace of Kings. The Grace of Kings is constructed as to thwart reader expectation a little bit because it starts out as one kind of book and finishes as a different kind of book. Mm-hmm. It starts out as a book about rebellion against tyranny, about rebels of every stripe coming together to overthrow an evil empire. And traditionally, a tale like that ends with the victory, the overthrow of the empire. But the victory actually is just the midpoint of the book, because after that point, the book becomes a very different kind of book, a book about friendships being torn asunder and about revolutionary ideals not being sustainable once you reach the common goal. And brothers turn against each other, and things start to fall apart. The second book also starts out as one kind of book and then ends up as a different kind of book, and I try to do something similar. It starts out as a book about political intrigue, about palace intrigue, really. And you sort of are, as a reader, are set up to expect a certain kind of conflict, types of conflict, and certain types of resolution. But halfway through the book, you realize that every member, really, in the intrigue has a much longer time horizon and much grander schemes in mind. And something new happens in the book that completely transforms the conflicts into a different kind of conflict, because now there's a different goal in mind for everyone to fight towards. And so the second half of the book becomes a very different kind of book than how readers might be expecting if they start out expecting a book about palace intrigue. And so structurally, it mirrors the first book in the same way, which is it's really two books in one. How it starts out is not how it ends. It really melds two narrative traditions and tries to tell a story that transforms halfway through, in the same way that Dara itself is a society in transformation.
Let's talk about that society a little bit and how it has changed in the 6 years between books.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically, the tavern is still there, or the idea of the tavern. It's not the same tavern, though. It's not
right. It's a different pattern tavern. Yeah.
But there's still that's that meeting point and that hub. And Wall of Storms kind of opens with four kids sneaking out to the tavern. A little bit. They're headed that way.
Right, right.
And you've got a four-year-old at a tavern, kid.
Well, actually,
I have to ask you why.
If you recall, she was actually not at the tavern.
No.
She was at home, back in home and studying. Mm-hmm. In fact, they make a big deal out of it afterwards, saying that, well, you know, not all the kids. One of them is still home. And,
right.
And of course, the schoolmaster is like, well, she's four, so that doesn't really mean a whole heck of a lot.
I want to talk about that a little bit, because rating kids when you have them is something that is completely unrelated to food. But I did want to talk about the fact is that both of your books have, as part of the narrative introduction to the local politics, a tavern scene.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What is it about taverns that calls to you when it comes time to sit down and really figure stuff out?
You know, so there's several things that I'm trying to do there. One of them is that the tavern is a great way to show the variety of social classes and professions and mm-hmm. just walks of life that are in the world. In the same way that, you know, the subway is sort of our melting pot in the urban environment, where people of all stations of life are gathered together, the tavern in my fantasy universe is the place where everybody can gather together and sort of be in a common context where information can be exchanged. This is a place that's outside of the strictures of class and profession and duty, and where everyone can sort of let their guard down and converse with each other and share stories. The other part of it is, you know, the Grace of Kings and the Wall of Storms are explicitly novels about storytelling, about story interpretation. Mm-hmm. They're really, in some ways, about the reading of foundational myth and the creation of foundational myth. And because they're tales about stories, about meta narratives. The idea of storytelling is very important. So in the first book, in the tavern scene, it's about a group of friends telling each other stories. And mm-hmm. we're told that Kuni is a great storyteller. This is one of his defining qualities. Metaphorically,
over some flagons or some glasses, yes, of things.
Exactly. And over time, of course, Kuni's storytelling in the tavern turns into a metaphorical reflection of his ability to craft a new narrative for the
right.
world of Zara,
right.
to tell a new story about the world. Now, in the second book, when we start out, you have a storyteller trying to entertain the tavern, the patrons of the tavern, with stories about what happened in the last book. These are very exaggerated legends, romantic visions of what had happened. It's both a way to remind the reader of what had happened in the first book, as well as a way to say, you know, we're actually shifting register now. We're in a new world in which what happened in the last book now appears as legends, as myth, as stories of days of yore to these people. And now they are subject to interpretation and miscomprehension and, and translation and all the rest of it.
Yes.
And finally, this is a really just a very personal note. As I mentioned, I think last time we spoke, The Grace of Kings and the entire series in some ways is inspired really by my love for the tradition of Chinese oral storytelling called Pingshu. And when I was a kid, I listened to storytellers on the radio tell us about Romance of the Three Kingdoms and the heroes of the Han Dynasty. And I listened to these broadcasts with my grandmother. And every day at lunch, I would run home so that I can be there on time. And as my grandmother and I ate, we would listen to the storyteller. And afterwards, I'd ask her questions about what was said. Just my love for storytelling and for that folk tradition of history came from that. And so...
So it really happened over food.
Yes, it did happen over food.
Yes, we're back.
Storytellers in China, the Bingshu storytellers, were always telling stories in tea houses. They told stories to patrons who were drinking and eating. And they had to tell stories that held their attention.
So that they would eat more.
Yes. So that was the prototype for the storyteller. That was a callback to the very origins of the series with the tavern scene.
Now I have many more questions. You've done it now.
Oh, boy.
I just toss out all my other questions and we're going for it. So Ken, as in the traditional role of a storyteller, what kind of tea house or tavern would you prefer to tell your stories in?
You know, that's a really good question. I actually, you're reminding me of something. I actually gave a lecture just the other day over lunch to a group of college students and professors, and it was actually a lot of fun. You know, there's something about telling a story over food that's just kind of unique, because you can make the food part of your prop for storytelling, right? You can pause at the right moment and take a drink. Or saying, you know, I really need to take another bite, and just leave the suspense and let it go on for a little bit longer. You can also, in some ways, flavor your stories with the food that people are enjoying. You know, when I was in the United Kingdom doing my little book tour. They had wine, because this is the UK, so they had wine in the bookstores before people showed up, and same thing in France, actually. And so they were asking me, you know, whether I wanted people to wait until I'd done my reading before they got their drinks. And I was like, no, people should drink. All stories are so much better, and authors are so much more interesting if all of you have some alcohol inside of you first. So... I definitely think drinking and eating is very conducive to enjoying a good story, and in more ways than one.
Okay. You didn't answer my question, though. Counselor, I'd like to put a motion.
I don't know. The witness must answer the question. I guess I would say I would not enjoy telling a story in the tavern in the Wall of Storms, because it's so much pressure.
It's probably pretty noisy too.
It's very noisy. I mean, if you look at the performers in these tea houses, they have to compete with all the conversations and the cracking of sunflower seeds and screaming kids and all the rest of it. It's really tough to maintain an audience under those kind of conditions. So I think it would be a little too challenging for me. I would not enjoy doing that. I think my favorite way to do it is if I'm actually just at the table with my friends, and we all just tell each other stories. That would be my preferred venue of performance.
Okay. That sounds ideal, actually, just sitting around and competitive storytelling over wine.
Competitive storytelling. More like collaborative storytelling. Or in other words, a role-playing session. Really.
In other words, exactly. It would just be like tabletop, but better, because it would be our characters.
Yes, exactly.
And a friend of mine made me a game for Cloudbound. That essentially potentially that, and we had the opportunity.
Cool!
It's not there yet, but I tend to get into character when I play games. So right now it's a lot of flying between towers and challenging people and things. And this is something we can talk about later. But
I just want to say that I hope there are tiles that you can tie around people's necks, because that would be.
That would be great if at the end of the game you were just draped in laws. But I think that whole because gaming, obviously you need food to game. You need crunchy food and salty food and all sorts of things.
And sweet food. Sweet food.
Oh, you have a sweet tooth?
I do.
So you're the one with the Oreos. I'm the one with like the chocolate covered potato chips.
Oh my god!
Have you never had these?
I have not, but that actually sounds dreadful.
How long have we known each other?
A long time, but I have never seen you. Honestly, I didn't even know about the existence of such a thing as chocolate covered potato chips.
We're gonna fix that.
This doesn't sound like the right thing to invent. I really am disturbed by the idea that this thing exists.
Fonda Lee and I are going to fix this problem right now. She didn't believe me either.
No, I believe you. I believe you. I just wish it had not been invented.
I would like to gently turn us back towards the topic of the Wall of Storms.
Okay. Yes, of course.
Because this is important that people know what a rich layering you have done on all aspects of community and court life and the hierarchy of first wife versus second wife and all of this. But I wanted to know was what research you did about food for this particular book, because you knew I was going to ask.
Yeah, I knew you were going to ask. Actually, quite a lot. you're going to really enjoy this. But one of the things I did was I read B. Wilson's book, Consider the Fork.
Oh, isn't that great?
Which is an amazing book about the history of cooking and about kitchen implements and about the technology of cooking and all the various ways we've learned to transfer heat into food and to control the rate at which food is being cooked and the ways we've invented for eating and consuming such food. So the Grace of Kings had its food focus, but the Wall of Storms in some ways is much more kitchen and food focused. Mm-hmm. There are multiple scenes discussing the technology of cooking and the role that cooking plays in the formation of culture. So the different cultures in the book, the invaders from the far north, have their own ways of preparing food and their own way of defining themselves based around their food. And the people of Dara of different regions also have their own unique ways of cooking and ways of defining themselves by food. This manifests itself in terms of the implements they use for eating, in terms of what they consider to be civilized food versus not civilized food.
Manners.
Yeah, manners. There's a lot of discussion about the manner in which you consume your food and what is considered good and what is considered bad. And there's a lot of interesting cultural discussion about how the values of culture are encoded in these rituals.
Can you go into that a little bit more? Because I think that's very interesting, and I think you can do it without spoilers.
Okay. I can try that.
I mean, it's fascinating.
So let me give you an example that's not from the book, but that's something that Aliette Dibodar and I were talking about on Twitter, which is that In the West, we think of a restaurant that is noisy as low class. If you go to a good restaurant, a restaurant that is good, people are quiet as they consume their food. They don't shout. There are no kids running around screaming. Food is consumed in a way that is quiet, and the ritual of food consumption is quiet and focused on excluding the boisterousness of those who don't appreciate it, apparently, children. When I was traveling around in China, one of the things that I noticed is that people are much more appreciative of restaurants that are very noisy and boisterous and have a lot of talk, shouts, and children running around. The idea is that if a restaurant is not noisy and demonstrating its ability to appeal to patrons of all different kinds and from all walks of life, then the food really isn't that good. If people are not enjoying themselves and actually happily drinking and telling stories and shouting to their friends and relatives across the table and yelling to the service folks for more food and more drink, then the restaurant just isn't very good. It's a very culturally dependent concept of what is a good restaurant. A good restaurant isn't necessarily one where things are quiet, but rather one that is noisy. And the consumption of food is about conversation, about loudness, about general display of being in a community. And I thought that was very interesting. It's an instance of cultural difference. And I recall, a lot of Westerners find restaurants in Chinatown to be just too noisy and too chaotic for them. And that's related in part to that, because that kind of uncontrolled boisterousness is part of it. I'm also reminded of another food-related observation, which is that when I was in Spain, my hosts were very amused that I wanted to eat dinner around 8 or 8:30. They were like, "Wow, the restaurants here don't really even open until 9. So you're a little bit too early for that." Mm-hmm. And I always found it very comical that, I thought I ate dinner late, but no. In Spain, I was an early bird that could not get the worm.
Let me ask you a question, because you are talking about noisy taverns being a positive thing, noisy restaurants being a positive thing, but you just mentioned that it would be a negative thing for a storyteller.
I don't think it would necessarily be a negative thing for a storyteller. I think it has to do with the sense in which you expect your story to be taken. I think, again, this is like attending concerts, right? Back yes. in the days when classical music was not actually classical music, concerts were often noisy affairs. I mean, people went there and they were talking, they were drinking, they were eating while the musicians played. Yes. The idea that we would go to a concert hall, sit there and just in utter silence, listening to the musicians play would have been ridiculous. That is not how people listened to classical music when classical music was country music. And so I think these expectations of performance and of how a piece of art will be interpreted and consumed change over time. And so that's just that. As a performer, I think I would have trouble with a very noisy environment simply because I'm not used to it. My expectations are not aligned with that model. But I think a storyteller who is who learns her craft in that environment would be able to do very well. In fact, she might find the way that we do our readings, in which everyone sits there in silence, listening and not fidgeting and just staring at the performer, to be rather intimidating and uncomfortable.
So we've talked a bit about different styles of eating, and we've talked a bit about noise level. What about actual foods and what is eaten in one community that is completely insulting to another community, or maybe just looked at with a serious side eye.
Yeah, I haven't discussed that too much in the book, except for one piece. There's one part where characters who are from a peasant background consume foods that are considered not really food by the wealthy folk. In this case, it's caterpillars, which are pickled as a snack. Because, you know, when you're poor, you don't get a lot of protein, and really any source of protein is valued. This is true of a lot of peasant cuisines around the world. You know, for the civilized folk in the big cities of Dara, this is not the sort of thing they wanted to see being eaten, and they did not want that to be consumed. So that's one example of that sort of thing being discussed. The third book would have more examples of that, because what is eaten and what is not eaten and has become for many of us a shorthand for discussing cultural values.
Yes.
We imbue foods we consume and don't consume with a kind of talismanic power. You know, we Americans, for example, do not generally like to consume food that looks like the animal it comes from. Pig heads, which are very popular as part of European traditional cooking, I think most of us would look on that with some sense of revulsion.
Heads. I worked at a farmer's market, and the butcher next door served a lot of the Greek Orthodox community, and so I saw lamb's heads being prepared every year.
Yep.
And it's an eyeful if you're not used to it.
Right. And I know that, you know, the traditional style of preparing and presenting fish in Chinese cooking is to present the whole fish. And I know that many Americans find the actual appearance of the fish with the fish head and so on to be disturbing. And similarly with chickens being served with their heads and other body parts intact. For a lot of us, because I think it's interesting, because in America, I think we have a tendency to insulate ourselves from the realities of what it means to have food. And so we sanitize death in a lot of ways that I don't necessarily think actually represents any kind of advancement or civilization. I think we like to think that it does, but it really doesn't. The way we sort of want to see fish only as fillet and chicken only as drumsticks and these disembodied body parts is in many ways to me disturbing, as though we want to avoid the reality of what it is we do when we consume food.
Have you ever had a pickled caterpillar?
I have not personally had one. But I would be very happy to try one.
That was my next question. And what kind of caterpillar? Is it one of the fuzzy ones, or is it one of the, you know, one of the sort of more moth-like caterpillars with the?
No, it's more of those not fuzzy, but you know, sort of fleshy. Okay. I guess is the word I would
kind of
use.
Kind of like a silkworm, but probably not a
silkworm. Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Right. Yeah.
Interesting. And what made you choose that particular item? Because it was memorable.
I think I did read somewhere about caterpillars actually being a traditional item of food, and I wanted to put that into part of the world building as an example of the kind of class distinction based on food that we practice.
Okay. Excellent. I've had this conversation a couple of times with Saladin Ahmed. Had a really good example in his books about the amount of cultural knowledge required to barter for food in the marketplace.
Oh, interesting.
Which was really cool. And you can go back in the Cooking the Books archives and find it. It's actually transcribed. The fact of the matter was, for him, the disadvantage was to the wealthier person. Because they never had done this, and they went out into the market and completely flubbed it and came home with, you know, some wilted vegetables and not enough to feed everybody. And, you know, the other person who had been going to the market and doing this, you know, all of their lives was able to barter and bargain much better.
Right. Well, so, that makes sense. Well, San is always so insightful on this sort of thing. Yeah. But I think it makes sense in the sense that this is always about reading of codes and the cultural milieu that you're more comfortable in. I mean, right. You know, in my book, there's this scene where Zomi, one of the characters whose background is much more peasantry. She goes to an environment in which she feels like a fish out of water. She doesn't even know how to clean herself after using the restroom because the situation is so different from what she's used to. She had one of those moments that's sort of like the three shells, you know.
Wow.
The three seashells.
Yes.
Where she was like, I don't know what to do, and it's a moment that sort of shows the. Just how uncomfortable you can be with these very, how helpless you can feel with these very basic daily life rituals when you're thrown into an entirely different class environment. And similarly, you know, someone who is wealthy and used to the rules of the environment in which they grow up would have a lot of trouble when suddenly thrown into a situation where those rules no longer apply, and you have to learn a whole new set of rules and to learn to perform very basic life tasks using a different set of tools and perhaps even through a different vocabulary.
Ken Liu, thank you so much for joining us on Cooking the Books.
And thank you very much, Fran. It's such a pleasure to be on your show.
It is always fun to have you, and you're welcome back, but you have to try the chocolate dipped potato chips first.
Oh, God. I don't know if I can wait or can't.
This has been Cooking the Books, an interview series about food and fiction. Tune in next time for another interview.